so excited to teach about this topic. I seriously agree with the quote. I think it was C.S. Lewis said, the most important thing about us is what we believe about God. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story, which is going to be difficult because I don't like doing that. And then you'll understand a little bit more about why I'm passionate about this. But first, two things. Number one, I don't tell you this because I want you to like feel sorry for me. On the contrary, I am blessed in a crazy way. Like, the amount of things that God had to put into place to get me where I am right now is crazy. Like, can only be explained if you're God. Because I couldn't have done it. I couldn't have gotten myself here. So it's not because I want to woe is me that I will tell you a little bit about my story. It is exactly the opposite. Thank you, Jesus. And then the other thing is that I want you to think through the things that you wrote about. Like, I want you to think through the things that, let's be honest, those are the places where Satan wants to attack. Those are the places where lies creep in. They change our perspective about Christ. They change our perspective about how God feels about us. And that changes everything, right? That's the foundation. Like, our what we know to be true about Christ, that's what we build our house on. So you have those faults in there. Like, you think maybe God isn't loving. Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he isn't. He's not impartial. Maybe he's not really paying attention to my situation. And then your foundation sucks and your house crumbles. And you get to be, you know, 40 and you fall away from your faith because it wasn't built on truth. And so that's why I'm passionate about this topic. I'm going to be 27 years old in like 1 week. Yeah. Crazy. And it has been an interesting almost few decades. Yeah, but God is sweet. So right before I was born, my mom found out she was pregnant. She told my father, and he told her to have an abortion, and she did not comply, obviously, because I'm talking to you. But because she didn't comply, he left her. So my mom has been alone for my entire life, and because she saw me as the catalyst to her loneliness, maybe, she just treated me really indifferently and was never really a mom to me. I want all of that to stop right there. There's also, yeah, a lot of poverty in my childhood. Like, we moved around a lot. There were, like, spurts of homelessness in my childhood. Just a lot of, like, my basic needs weren't met through a good part of it. Yeah, that was like the beginning of my life. The only time I ever saw my father in person, he did not acknowledge my existence. He talked to my mom, and I didn't even realize like how hurtful that was. And that was like, you know, 22 years ago or something. I didn't realize how hurtful that was until recently. Like, that is my only interaction with him, like, ever. In elementary school, it was terrible. Like, I was an extreme outcast, and we'll leave it at that. I had a friend named David, and he was one of my few friends, and he was born with water on the brain, and so he had a mental disability. And right after Christmas, when I was in the third grade, he had a lot of complications due to that, and then he passed away. And it was weird. Wow, what is going on here? It was weird because I was so young, but I prayed so diligently, like, please don't, like, take my friend from me. And that didn't work because he died. And that was the same year that my oldest cousin Mike got shot and died. And it was, like, terrible in my family. Like, not only was the act itself terrible and horrifying, and I was too young to, like, understand that these people were being taken out of my life forever, but what it did to my family and what the consequences of it that are still being experienced now were terrible. The next year, I was sexually abused by a friend of my mother's. Friend of my mother's. And I learned for sure that the world is not safe. Like, if anybody's going to look out for me, if anybody's going to take care of Takasha, it's going to be Takasha. Like, there's, yeah, it was really early on in life to, like, find out, like, really hard things that I thought to be absolute truth, right? Because there's nothing else in my life speaking differently. And so, yeah, I just took that to be that. The only male presence in my life that was steady in any way was my uncle, who was a raging alcoholic and often did life-changing, terrible things to my family. And that was my view of, like, what a man is, right? And so that was hard. By middle school, I was completely self-sufficient. Like, before that, honestly, but the reason I say middle school is because I was on my own. Like, when I woke up for school in the morning, my mom was already gone. She was at work, and then she went from her first job to her second job, and then I would come home from school and I would go to sleep and she would come home from her second job. I literally did not see her until Saturday afternoon, and she was going back to school on Saturdays in the morning. And so when I would get up at Saturday, like, morning, she wouldn't be there. And then in the afternoon she would come home. That would be the first time that I would see her during the week. And so I was seriously on my own. Enter God. Thank you, Jesus. I had a friend, Addie. I won't go into a lot of detail about this, but I had a friend named Addie who was different. She was different. Her speech was different. She didn't cuss like we did. She wasn't sexually immoral like we were. She was different. And I started going to church with her and her mom, and everything about my life changed, right? Christ enters, my perspective changed. I was blessed with a home church where I learned and I was challenged every week, and it was great. Tons of healing from a lot of things. But what didn't change was this lack of trust in God. What didn't change is that I needed to take care of Takasha. And that is still something that I deal with every single day. That's still something that it's my first instinct. Like, I need something. What do I do to take care of it? What do I do to take care of Takasha? Because that's what I was born into. That's what I've been taught, right? But there's something huge missing in this. I didn't understand God's love at all. Like, I didn't understand the good things about following Christ. I did understand sin. I understood that very well because I was super sinful. I was a heathen to my core. I understood the punishment of sin, or I thought so. For the better part of my childhood, my friend David that died when I was in the third grade, I thought he died because I was mean to him the last time that I saw him. And so I thought I understood the punishment of sin. I was beginning to understand grace, but none of this was connected to love for me. I saw God as like a warrior, and I was a soldier who was going to fight on God's side because he was right, you know? Like, he was the good guy, and so I'll do what he says. I can be on his side, kind of a thing. But it was all without love as a motivation. It was all without relationship. There was no relationship other than, like, you know, master to servant, or warrior to soldier, or commander to soldier. And doing this life without love as a motivation is empty, and it is tiring, and it is terrible. And so, if I can sit this however many people's down in this room and convey to you the truth about God's love, I feel like I will have done more than I could have ever asked with the tragedy that I faced. So, why does any of this matter? Like, why does it matter if we don't see God as loving or even as good? It matters very much, and we'll get back to the why later on. But what we will talk about now is the how. How do we not trust him? Even subconsciously. Because when we doubt God, and we all do doubt God from time to time, we doubt him in three areas. Either in his methodology, like, why in the world do you do things the way that you do it? Because if I were God, I wouldn't do anything the way he does it, right? or we doubt him in his ability. Like, can God actually control this situation? Like, does he actually have the power to change this situation? Or third, which is definitely where I fall, is that we doubt his goodness. He may be able to do anything at all. He's the God of the universe, right? But he doesn't. He doesn't intercede on my behalf. He does not protect me when I need to be protected. Or, like, I'm just not a priority to him. Yeah. And he's taught me a ton about this. And I could tell you all about that. I could tell you about all the situations where he's been growing me in this. Or we can start where God started with me, which is the story of Lazarus. And so that's what we're going to do for the rest of this time, is we're just going to talk about John 11. And right now is the time for you to pull these out. You will need them. Yeah. I'm going to pray, because this is a time to pray. Father, thank you so much for the truth about who you are. I thank you so much that, yeah, no matter what Satan does, no matter how he spins our circumstances, no matter how many times he gets a foot in the door, he can't change anything about who you are. Can't change anything about your heart towards us. Can't change anything about what you desire for good. And I just pray that you would open our eyes now to see the truth in our situations. And I thank you for the people in this room. I pray that you would soften our hearts. I pray that you would give us ears to hear. I pray that you'd speak through me now. And that this would be your time. That you felt like you had a captive audience here listening to you. And let me be one of them. And I pray that in Jesus' perfect name. Amen. Yeah, so this is... an informal time. I haven't planned anything super crazy. We're really going to go through this the way that I studied it the first time that God opened my eyes to the truth about his love. And so we're going to break it down into sections, and I'm going to point some things out to you in each section, and we're going to go through the story. Somebody want to read John 11, 1 through 7 out loud to us?
Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary, and her sister Martha. It was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. So the sisters sent word to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. But when Jesus heard this, he said, This sickness is not to end in death, but for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified by it. Now Jesus loved Martha, and her sister, and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then he said to the disciples, Let us go to Judea again.
So verses 1 and 2 are just context, right? They're in the city Bethany where Lazarus and Mary and Martha live. And Mary and Martha and Lazarus are dear to the Lord. And Lazarus is sick, right? And then it talks about Mary like pouring like oil on Jesus and anointing him for his burial. That hasn't happened yet. That happens later. But it's just giving you context. These are the people that they're talking about. So Lazarus is sick. He's dying. He's on his deathbed. And Mary and Martha send to Jesus and say, the one that you love is sick. So it's like the first plea, right? They don't come out right and say, hey, come save my brother. But she appeals to the fact that Christ loves him. This man that you love is sick. And what assurance does he give her? He just says the end result isn't death, but it's my glory. Okay. Verses 5 through 7. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. And then he says, let's go back. Doesn't say yet. It doesn't say Christ finds out Lazarus is sick And, you know, it's okay, he still stays. He loves them, and so he stays where he is. He could have went there, right? He could have went there right then. He's already healed people. Everybody knows that he can do that, but he doesn't do that. He loves them, so he stays. And I circled that in my Bible, and I looked at it like 5 times, because that doesn't make sense to my human mind. I don't understand. You love me, and I plead for my brother. I plead, because I want you to come save him. Don't be fooled. That's what they wanted. And so he stayed where he was. And that only makes sense in relation to verse 4, right? He says, "This sickness is not unto death, but is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." If the point of the sickness was to bring death, Jesus raising him from the dead would have defeated his purposes, right? If the point of it was for him to die, then Jesus raising him from the dead would have defeated his purposes. That was not the point of the sickness, and Christ makes that known. And we know the end of the story, right? Because the tagline at the top of your chapter says, Jesus raises Lazarus. We know what happens. They did not. They did not know. And that's important. That's important later, too. And let's talk about this love thing, because, yeah, it was super confusing to me reading this the first time. That whole "so" thing, he loved them, and so he didn't come to their side when they pleaded for him. That brings questions to me, but let's look at the specific words "love" in there. The first time that it said, it's when Mary and Martha send the messenger to Christ, and they say, "The one that you love is sick." They don't say the one that loves you dearly. Oh, hey, the one that loves you dearly is sick. They say the one that you love is sick. Well, it makes me think of the verse, "Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us." And Matthew Henry said, "Our love to him is not worth speaking of, but his to us can never enough be spoken of." I love that they appeal to the fact that Christ loved him, not the fact that Lazarus loved Christ. I think it's important. And then in verse 3, when they do make that appeal, specifically, and I'm sure you know this, but there's a lot of times when the English language falls short for us, right? And love is a huge one. In verse 3, when it says, "Therefore the sister sent to him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." The word that they're using is phileo. And it's cool, I'm about to be a word nerd for a second. But that word means to approve of, to like, to befriend. It is a term of friendship. When Mary and Martha were saying, "This person that you love," they're saying, like, the way that I love Chelsea, or the way that I love, you know, another person in this room. Like, and to be more of a word nerd, that verb, it is present, it is active, and it is indicative. Present meaning it's happening right now. Active meaning that it's an actual verb. This is an actual action. You love him. It's something that you are doing. And then indicative, it is a statement of fact. And so then jump to verse 5. When John is talking about how Jesus loves them, it says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus." But the word that he's using is agape. Completely different thing. He's saying, like, agape means to welcome in. It means to love tenderly and passionately. And that word is also indicative, and it is also active. It is a statement of fact, and it is a verb. The difference is that, it's not indicative. It's imperfect, which means that it is repetitive. It repeats. So what he's saying is, Christ loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus forever, and he always will. And he loves them passionately. That's not what Mary and Martha. That's not what they said. They said, "The one that you love like a friend." And so the first huge truth about God's love is that we underestimate it. We don't understand the depth of his love. And they show that clearly in the fact that they don't use the words that he would use. So he waits, right? We have the good fortune of looking at this from the outside, and after this has happened, long after this has happened, so we know the end of the story. We know that Jesus raises Lazarus from the dead, but what's it look like to them from the inside? If you're Mary or you're Martha, which you are, what's it look like to them? This is an actual question.
I would have been really... I taught this lesson for some kids in Sunday school. And I would have been really angry. Like, why didn't you come immediately?
Yeah.
Like, that's how I feel when I'm upset and I feel like God's not coming to me. I can't hear him clearly. I'm like, why aren't you comforting me? Like you said earlier.
Seriously. Be
like,
angry.
I need,
yeah. Be angry. What else?
Abandoned.
Abandoned.
Betrayed.
And betrayed. All of these issues are ones about his goodness, right? If we're doubting one of those three things, these are all about goodness. What about you? Yeah.
It's like, how did you let this happen to something that was so good?
Yeah.
It's just general hurt and doubt.
Yeah. We're going to talk about doubt.
Yeah.
Hurt. You're brokenhearted, right? Why weren't you there for me? Why weren't you there for me when I called you? That's how they would see that from inside this situation. But what can we see on the outside? Like, what is this really? We know at this point Christ had already healed people. Christ had already brought people back from the dead. But what's different about this? Like, Christ could have went there when he got the messenger. He could have went there and he could have healed him before he ever died, right? He'd already done that. He could have done that again. He'd done that for many. Or he could have went there right after he died and he could have risen for the dead, because he did that for some. But Christ waits 4 days. Like, the book reveals to us that Christ waits 4 days. And so what he's going to do for Lazarus, he hadn't done for any. Like, this is an opportunity for him to do something that he hadn't done for anyone. And that's going to be important. Can we believe that even when it doesn't look like it, he is planning something glorious for us? Like, even when we can't see it, even when it doesn't feel like it, he is planning something glorious for us, something that we don't understand. We need to be able to believe it. And it says in Isaiah 54, "For a mere moment I have forsaken you, but with great mercies I will gather you." That's one of my favorite verses. Isaiah 54:7, "For a mere moment I have forsaken you, but with great mercies I will gather you." I know exactly where you are. I know exactly what you're dealing with. I know that you feel alone. I have a plan for it, and I'll use it. Will somebody read verses 11 to 15?
He said this and then told them, "Our friend Lazarus is asleep, but I'm going to awaken him." So the disciples said to him, "Master, he's asleep. He will be saved." But Jesus was talking about his death. Well, they thought that he meant ordinary sleep. So Jesus said to them, "Clearly, Lazarus has died, and I am glad for you that I was not there, that you may believe. Let us go to him."
So enter another reason why Christ would wait. So the first one was that what he can do for Lazarus, he hasn't done for anyone. Enter reason number two, which is that it is for the help of the disciples' belief. He could have went there and healed him right away, right? And the disciples wouldn't have seen anything that they haven't seen before, and their belief wouldn't have been helped. It wouldn't have been grown. What does Christ say to them? "And I am glad for your sakes." He's talking to his chosen. This is not unbelievers. He's talking to his chosen, the people that dropped everything to follow him. "I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe." Reason number two, because we need our faith strengthened. We need to see things that only God can do, right? We need our faith strengthened. Verses 16 to 28. This is a big one. Who's going to take it?
Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us go, that we may die with him." On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus has already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day.
3:26.
Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, she said to him, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world.
Yeah, a little bit of context about the verses that we skipped. In 16, Thomas says, let us go that we may die with him. That is because where they're going is super dangerous for them. The Jews already hate them there, and the disciples are positive that if they go there, they're going to be killed. So also understand that Jesus going was not something that the disciples would have taken lightly. It was dangerous, physically dangerous for them. That's what Thomas is talking about when he says, let us go die with him. Let us stand beside the Lord, even if it causes our death. Side note, because we skipped that. So verse 21 is where Martha gets to be at the feet of the Lord, and she says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. We can read that without emotion, or you can think about what actually happened, because she lost her dear brother and she petitioned to the Lord for him, right? She sends to him, you know, this man that you love and that I love dearly is going to pass. And she's not saying this without emotion. Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. She's brokenhearted. Where were you? I needed you. She's not questioning his ability, because what does she say? If you were here, he wouldn't have died. I know that you can do it. She's not questioning his ability. She's questioning his goodness. Martha doesn't understand what he's doing or why he's doing it, but she does understand who he is, because she acknowledges it right after, right? But I know that you're the Son of God. I still know that right now, whatever you ask for, God will give you. We can learn from her faith, even though she didn't understand the situation at all. Even when Christ tells her, I'll raise your brother, she's like, I know he will be raised in the last day when all saints are raised. She doesn't understand what's going on, but we can learn from her faith. She still acknowledges that God is who he is. And we need that, right? We need that for our foundation. We need to understand the truth about him, that he is good, that even in our worst circumstances, he is working good for us. That's what Neil just said, right? In our worst circumstances, he is working good for us, even if we can't see it. And then 29 through 36.
So Mary immediately went to him. Now Jesus had stayed outside the village at the place where Martha met him. When the people who were at the house trying to console Mary saw her leave so hastily, they assumed she was going to Lazarus' grave to weep. So they followed her there. When Mary arrived and saw Jesus, she fell down at his feet and said, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping and saw the other people wailing with her, he was moved with indignation and was deeply troubled. Where have you put him? He asked them. They told him, Lord, come and see. Then Jesus wept. The people who were standing nearby said, see how much he loved him.
Second huge, huge truth is that Christ cares so much. He cares so much. I don't know why this was revolutionary to me when I was studying this, because I didn't think that he did. He's not the detached puppet master who's up there like, do my bidding, little ones, pulling strings so that we will fight for him, so that we will work out his will. Like, he couldn't raise rocks to do it. He cares so much. Your version said that he was moved with indignation. Mine said that he groaned in his spirit and was troubled. He cares so much. Things that you need to know, that you know, that you know, that you know, that you know. Christ cares. He is not detached. He cares so much about what is going on in your life. He cares so much about the little details that are going on in your life. And then he wept for them, right? He wept for his friend Lazarus, and he wept because Mary and Martha were in pain, and he loved them. And he wept because he saw the witnesses of people following behind her who were grieving with her because she lost something dear to her. He was heartbroken. He really does care. I don't know if that's revolutionary to you, but seriously, the first time God led me through this, I didn't know what to do. You really care. I will take that. I need that. In 1 Peter 5:7, another says, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Giving your burdens to the Lord, because he cares about what happens to you. Not because he needs you to be the person that is doing what he needs you to do, because he cares about your heart. Because he wants to be intimate with you, because he calls himself a friend of yours. You get to be a friend of God's. He cares so much. Let's finish out the section 37 through 45. I'm going to read it. And some of them said, and the them is the crowd of witnesses that are following Mary and Martha, they're Jewish people. It says, and some of them said, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? And then Jesus, again groaning in himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he's been dead for 4 days. And Jesus said, did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? And then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I have said this, that they may believe that you sent me. Now when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And when he who had died came out, bound hand and foot with grave cloths, and his face was wrapped with a cloth, Jesus said to him, loose him and let him go. And then many of the Jews who had come to Mary had seen the things Jesus did and believed in him. So, don't belittle what was done here, because it sounds commonplace to us. He raised Lazarus from the dead. We know that. I don't know. I would assume most of the people in this room probably raised in church. And we've heard that story 1,000 times. And it sounds normal to us, right? It sounds normal because we know that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. But it was huge for them. They didn't know how the story was going to end. And a little context that will make this make you understand why this was very big for them. He'd raised someone from the dead, but there's something else. There's a lot of context in Martha's words in verse 39. She says, when he says, take away the stone, Martha says, by this time there's a stench, for he's been dead for 4 days. The Jews believe that for 3 days after you died, those first 3 days, your soul and your body were still connected. The soul was hoping to be reconnected to the body, that you could still come back. After the third day, your body started to decompose, and your soul and your body were divided forever. So why did Christ wait for these 4 days, right? This is huge. This is huge in their context. It doesn't make that much sense in ours because we wouldn't think about it. It is huge to them that Christ waits 4 days. It makes so much sense that Mary would say, don't do that, it's too late. What's she really saying to Christ? Thank you for grieving with me, but it's too late. There's nothing we can do about it now, it's been 4 days. Do you see it? Do you see what we're getting to here? There is another huge motivation for Christ to have waited. Did he do it out of his indifference? Like, well, you know, I'm going to get there. I'm going to get back there when I can. It'll be okay. Like, I know what's going to happen. Or did he do it because there are huge, huge, huge things at stake here? It's the witnesses. It's the witnesses that are following Mary and Martha. In verse 37, they say, could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying? What are they admitting here? They're admitting that they have seen the miracles of Christ. They've watched him make people see who were blind, like paralyzed people stand up and walk away. They've seen the miracles of Christ and they still don't believe. That's what they're admitting in verse 37. They needed to see this to believe, and Christ knew it. Christ knew it. Was it his indifference that made him wait, or was it because there was something huge to be gained in it? And it was a lot of people who did not believe in him, though they saw the miracles he could perform, and he knew that this is what they needed to see to believe. He knew that in the context of this culture, that waiting 4 days after the death was going to mean something to them unlike anything that they'd ever seen. Because what happens right after this, right? He goes into Jerusalem for the Passover, and then the next week he's killed. Christ knows what's coming. This is huge. And in fact, if you keep going chapter 12, starting in verse 9, it says, "Now a great many of the Jews knew that he was there," he is Christ, "and they came, not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests plotted to put Lazarus to death also, because on account of him, many of the Jews went away and believed in Christ." Jesus knew that the end result of this would mean way more people would understand that he was the Lord's, that he was sent from the Lord, that he was God himself, that he could do things that no one else could do. He could do things that were impossible to them. And people believed. Lots and lots of people believed. It was amazing. It wasn't the kind of news that doesn't travel. People knew, and they believed. So let's wrap it up. What all is accomplished here? It's huge. Because Mary and Martha, right? He deferred coming to them, and so much came out of that. They were tried. Their faith was tried. Someone read 1 Peter 1:6-7. Someone flip to that. I'm actually going to read it because I'm here. Did you want to read it? It says, "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ." That's what Mary and Martha got, right? That your faith would be tested and it would be proved to be glorious. That they're grown in this, that they are made stronger in their faith. They're made stronger as witnesses. They're made stronger as women because they went through this. And their faith is not something that can be purchased. It's not something with little value, right? It's worth more than gold that perishes. It does not perish. Not only does it not perish, but it brings people into eternity with us. Into a positive eternity anyways. We're all eternal. That's what Mary and Martha got from this. But what were they thinking? I mean, I wasn't there. I can't ask them what they were thinking, but I can guess because I know what I think. I guess that they're thinking, this is hurtful. Why weren't you there for me? But what they got was faith that was refined, that was strengthened. And that is invaluable. If you are my brother and sister in Christ, then in your deepest places, you desire that. You desire that. Sometimes it makes sense for him to wait. And then the disciples, their strength was faith. Their faith was strengthened. Because Jesus held out and he showed them something that they hadn't seen before. Their faith was strengthened because he waited. And then the witnesses who wouldn't have known him. They wouldn't have known him. They would have died without knowing the truth about Christ. And he knew that. He knew what they needed to see. And then anyone that would hear after, not just the crowd of witnesses that was there to see it, but everyone who heard after, they looked for Lazarus and they believed because of it. I think the reason that this hit me so hard the first time that I was led to it was because it is not often in our lives that we get to see why things happen the way they do, right? It's not often that we get to look back at something and be like, that all makes sense. most of the time that is not true in my life. But this is a case where we can see it. We can see why him waiting was good. We can see why him waiting was not indifference. It was not a lack of love. It was the exact opposite. Because he is patient. And he's long-suffering with us, not willing that any should perish. Thank you so much, Jesus, for being willing to wait sometimes when I don't want you to. He loves us huge. He loves us huge. He loves us so much that when we turn around, when we don't pay attention to what he says, when we ignore him, when we disobey him, when we crucify him, he would willingly do it for the joy that was set before him. And that is being with us, that is intimacy with us. Willingly, he would willingly endure that to be with us. He loves us huge. Don't ever, 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 ever let Satan tell you otherwise. Don't let Satan make you think that your circumstances, the times that you have to wait, the times that you don't understand why things happen the way that they do, mean that Christ doesn't love you, because he is weaving a story that is so much more intricate than we can see. What is this truth? What is the huge truth that we're getting at here? It's that God is transcendent. The truth about God's love is that he is transcendent, and his love is transcendent. It is outside of us. It is outside of our understanding. It is outside of what we are capable of getting. It doesn't mean it's not there. It's the reason that in Proverbs it says 3, 5, and 6 says, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths. Don't lean on your own understanding, because God's love is transcendent. If we could make sense of it by our circumstances, he'd be a pretty small God. What can you see in your life, in your little tiny life web? Like, I can see what's going on around me right now. I have no idea what he's putting together with it. He's transcendent. But if we judge his heart by what we see, we'll always be deceived. Always. And then the last thing, the last truth about his love is that it's not all about us. Christ loves you passionately, deeply. He would die for you. He did die for you. It's not all about us, right? I don't always get what I want. I definitely don't always get what I want when I want it. It's not because he doesn't love me. It's not because he doesn't see my pain. It's not because he doesn't want to protect me. That's not truth. That is Satan. But there is a big part of there is a very big story that we are part of, right? This concept of new eyes, new vision. We should be people that are out to change the world. One day we won't have a choice. One day we won't have a chance to do that anymore, because this will be done. We'll be with our Father. I don't want to look back and say, man, I thought about myself the entire time. I don't want to look back and say, I did not do everything I could to pull everyone through the kingdom of heaven with me, right? He loves us huge, but it's not all about us. He uses our pain, he uses our trial, he uses the things that were denied, and he reaches people with them. Those witnesses, they wouldn't have known him if he hadn't waited the 4 days. The people that were in Jerusalem afterwards, they wouldn't have known him if he didn't wait. And I asked the question at the beginning, why is it important? Why does it matter how we see God? And I think the reason is because what we believe, it's like a tree, right? The roots are what we believe, and what we believe is going to come out in our actions. It's going to be like the tree. And what we do with our time, how we spend our time, which is directly linked to what we believe, Because if I believe that God is the most important thing, if I believe that he loves me passionately, if I believe that my circumstances have nothing to do with his love, it's going to change my actions, right? I'm going to give my life to Christ. I'm going to try to bring people through the gates with me. And our fruits, at the end of all this, what comes out of our actions, it's going to be completely related to what we first believed. I think it matters a lot. I think it sets the course of our life. I think that what we believe about God is the most important thing about us. And like me, in my first like 5 years walking with Christ, when none of it was motivated by love, right? I was just like, well, he's in the right, so I'm going to do it. I'm going to do what I have to do. Number one, that doesn't last. Number two, the fruit from that was not positive. The fruit from that was super shallow because I didn't have the relationship with him. Well, that's not what I want. I want us to be people who our roots go deep. We know the truth. Our foundations are strong. And we're not shaken. We're not the house that's built on the sand. We're not shaken in those things. We know how Christ feels about us. I'll leave you with a verse. 1 Peter 5:10 says, "But may the God of all grace, who called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you." His plans for us are good. His heart towards us is good. I'm going to give you one. Everybody, there are index cards being passed around right now. I did this with my life group, and I've been doing it since I was a freshman in college. And it's seriously been life-changing for me. But I want you to take a second, and you don't even need to do this right now if you don't want to, but to write down the things that you know, that you know, that you know about Christ. The first one on my card says, "I know that I know that I know that Christ loves me despite my circumstances." And the second one on my card says that I know that Christ would not have went to the cross if it wasn't motivated by love. Because there is no good reason to do that. It's horrific. And then I want you to keep these cards with you for as long as you can. Put them in your back pocket. Change them over every day. And when you're tempted to believe something differently, take it out and look at it. Because there is a father of lies that wants to destroy you. He doesn't want to set you back. He wants to kill you. He wants to destroy you. But the truth about God is that he loves us passionately, and that we can't see that through our circumstances all the time doesn't make it less true. And then in our last couple minutes, I mean, literally, we'll only have a minute or two each. If we could just break off in twos, I believe in the power of prayer, and I want us to pray for each other. So if you could just pick one person beside you and pray for them for a minute and let them pray for you for a minute. That God would make his love so known to us that it would be the driving force in our life. That everything we do would come out of the fact that we are loved, treasured, fought for, and paid for by Christ.